Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press and the Helles Foundation. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Anne Gislason about her memoir, The Futilitarians, Our Year of Thinking, Drinking, Grieving, and Reading. Gislason possesses one of New Orleans' best and brightest literary voices. Her work has appeared in the Oxford American, The Believer, The Atlantic, and the Los Angeles Times. She teaches creative writing at the New Orleans Center for Creative Arts, and she's the co-founder of Antenna and Press Street. Today, we'll be talking about a year in her reading life, chronicled in the memoir The Futilitarians, Our Year of Thinking, Drinking, Grieving, and Reading. Anne Gislason, welcome. Welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you so much for having me.
What a book. How could I not love this book? It's just a year of reading. So tell me about the Existential Crisis Reading Group. Whenever I say that to anybody, they get it immediately. You know what I mean? So how did it come into being?
So it was the end of 2011. It was December. And friend of ours, a good family friend, Chris, approached me about doing some readings, doing some one-on-one philosophical readings. He was working through some existential problems of his own. And at the time, I was feeling very just overwhelmed by life, you know, teaching and family and child rearing and all of that. But like, any occasion for a social venture was very welcome. And so I said, well, you know, why don't we open it up to a group of people and do it as a sort of, you know, reading group book club sort of thing? And he said, sure. And so my husband and I, one afternoon, we took the kids down to the Hot Walk Buffet down in St. Bernard Parish, and we just started making a list of people who we thought might be into this venture. And so we made this list. We thought really hard about the people, about their certain qualities and whether or not they would be into doing something like this. And then we just started approaching people, kind of one by one. And we were surprised that with the alacrity that people responded, sometimes mid-sentence, like, oh, we're thinking about doing this existential crisis reading. They'd be saying, yes, absolutely. I would love to do something like that. Sometimes maybe it took a few minutes or a few days to return an email. But we ended up coming up with a group of about 12 core people who were really into doing it.
The readings are so interesting. I was struck the whole time by the care with which you selected these readings. It was really wonderful. So tell us some of the more memorable texts that you chose for this. And everybody chose, you know, everybody had input, of course.
Yeah, that's interesting that you used the word that so much care was chosen, because it's a group project. And any group project is going to have its own energy. And this is a really smart, fun group of people. So each text would be chosen in response to whatever reading was happening that night. So like March's text would be in response to February's text, or July's text would be in response to June's text, that sort of thing. Sometimes I broke down a little bit. So it's this really kind of a collective, almost like raucous process of how these things come up and how they emerge out of the group. So it doesn't feel like care necessarily. It feels like it's coming out of the collective energy of the group and whatever that discussion was. And some of these discussions go on, you know, 3-4 hours. And then the reading just emerges from that. It's like, well, I think it'd be really great if we did this Arthur Koestler in response to kind of the absurdity of the situation from the Borofsky reading that we were doing that night. So it's that sort of thing.
And there's that sense of the great energy of literary works in conversation with each other.
Yeah.
You know, which is always so fascinating to watch.
Absolutely.
But everybody in the group had personal stuff going on. So talk about some of the swirling personal energies that people were addressing as well at the time.
One of the things that I really love about this group of people is that everyone has very different types of lives that they're leading. And so, you know, a few of us had children. And so some would be centered around kind of parental anxiety. others are maybe in a different part of their lives. We had a few younger people in their group who were going through, quote unquote, like quarter life crises, right. Which I could never quite identify with a quarter life crisis.
I miss that crisis
myself. Because I think I say in the book, like my whole 20s seemed like a crisis of becoming, just like trying to be like get to some stable place in adulthood. And, you know, some people were trying to figure out professionally what to do. And some people just had some like deep existential issues that they had been struggling with for like quite some time that they just wanted to just sit down with some other people and just have the space to talk about these things.
Now, a lot of it, I mean, the drinking part of it, we all get, you know, it's like the old my book club can drink your book club under the table. Uh-huh. You know what I mean? But the grieving part of it mm-hmm. is really the moving part of this book. And I think the part that touches everyone's lives, whether or not they're in an existential crisis reading group. And you were grieving quite a lot at that time.
Well, that was kind of the most powerful thing for me about the group's formation was that literally a week later, my father died. And he had been ill, so it wasn't completely unexpected, but he was going through an upswing where we thought things were looking really good for him. And it happened in the beginning of January. And I remember we had our first existential crisis reading group on January 5th. And as all New Orleanians know, January 6th is Epiphany, which is the Feast of the Epiphany and the beginning of carnival season. And it was that next day that my father, with zero immunity, had driven up to Angola to meet his death row pro bono client. And from that ride, and he came back exhausted, and he was literally hospitalized and died within days. And so the confluence of those two things happening at the same time, the existential crisis reading group, my father dying at the same time, and both of those things opened up so much inside of me. And as anybody knows who's lost somebody close to them, that grief kind of echoes all the other grieving that you've done in your life. And it's everything becomes very compounded and raw. And so the fact that like once a month I could get together with these wonderful friends and read these works that kind of connected, that kind of give some sort of like shape and form to the grief and to these thoughts, even if we weren't reading things that specifically had to do with grief, it helped me sort of reconnect to the contours of my life. And it was just extremely like affirming and really helped me get through that first year.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're grappling with such deep questions in this group and doing, at its heart, spiritual work. Mm-hmm. You know, that is a kind of work that we have to do in our lives. And you chose one month a really particularly interesting approach to the reading group, and that was everyone picked a Station of the Cross in your neighborhood and did a reading at that spot. So I wonder if you'd give us a sense of that experience, which is hands down the most unusual reading group experience in New Orleans, I think, of just what happened. I wonder if you'd talk about your reading from that night and read us a little bit from the book.
Oh, sure. Well, the way that came up is for the March reading, we had read Arthur Kessler, and he was talking about the night journey that people kind of undergo, like kind of the dark night of the soul. You know, Jesus in the desert, that sort of thing, you know, Jonah and the whale, and coming out on the other side with some sort of like spiritual clarity or clarity about the world, having gone through that dark night of the soul. And actually, the whole Stations of the Crisis thing came up because at the end of the long night of discussing the Kessler, we all looked at our calendars to pick the next meeting group for April, and we noticed that it was going to be on Holy Thursday. And we're like, oh, Holy Thursday. And then we started talking about the Xavier Silos Church on the corner, and they do a procession throughout the neighborhood of the Stations of the Cross. And some of us in the room, especially me and my sister Susan, grew up very Catholic and very steeped in these Catholic rituals. And someone said, oh my God, we should do a Stations of the Crisis. And after that, everybody knew that was done. And it was a combination of looking at our calendar to schedule the next one and the Arthur Kessler reading. And it's kind of honestly just like a sense of fun and irreverence that we have. And so we all just pulled, I think there were the 14 stations that we did. Everyone just pulled a number out of a hat, literally, and was just randomly assigned a station. And if you don't know, if you're not Catholic or Christian, don't know what the Stations or the Passion of the Christ, it's basically, it begins with, you know, Christ is condemned to death, and it's kind of just walking through his passion or all the steps that lead to his death and eventual resurrection. And so Jesus is condemned to death. Jesus falls for the first time. Jesus meets his mother, that sort of thing, until he's crucified and then finally reborn. And so mine, the one that I got was Simon of Cyrene is made to bear his cross. And so you're just kind of randomly assigned your station. And And so what does it mean to have to bear somebody's cross and bear their pain? I mean, it's become sort of a cliche, an idiom, you know, bearing someone's cross. And so I just started thinking about that. And then it led me to a kind of goofy, unconventional place.
So I'd love to have you read that.
Sure. Okay, I'm going to start with the end of the previous station, which was Jesus meets his Blessed Mother. So I'm just going to segue from that. Beneath the uneven wash of the playground's floodlight, Sarah also read a dark, questioning poem by Louise Glick called Mother and Child, about the mysteries of birth and existence and family, which ends with the lines, "Why do I suffer? Why am I ignorant? Cells in a great darkness. Some machine made us. It is your turn to address it, to go back asking, what am I for? What am I for?" Then Sarah handed out white blackboard chalk and asked everyone to write, "What am I for?" which for some became, "What am I here for?" all over the playground. Some wrote it on the pliant, rough safety surfacing beneath the equipment, some on the slings of the swings, others on the concrete memorial bench. Sarah wrote it on a skateboard that some kid had left behind. Simon of Cyrene is made to bear his cross. My station. We stayed in the park, gathered near the shadowy play equipment, and I talked about Simon's role in the Passion. Jesus' physical exhaustion was holding up the procession, so the Roman soldiers found someone in the crowd, most likely strong-looking and possibly, as some believe, very dark-skinned, to force the cross upon. In that time, living under the empire meant that if a Roman soldier asked you to do something, you had to drop everything and do it. Simon had no choice. It would have been considered one of the worst indignities, humiliating, to be forced to carry a condemned man's cross for him through a crowd. Simon came to watch, and suddenly he was part of the spectacle. What was Simon's reaction to being chosen? How long did the wood, this alien burden, cut into his shoulder? Did he say anything to Jesus as he hoisted it back to him? Did some sweaty, bloodied, exhausted intimacy pass between them? There's speculation that instead of the experience fomenting resentment in Simon, he was moved to follow Jesus' teaching, mainly because in Mark's gospel, the names of his sons are mentioned, which is considered a great honor. Simon was the first to take up Jesus' cross, literally, and endure a segment of his suffering. When, through oppression or circumstance, we are forced to do something we might not have otherwise done, it must define us in some special, sharper way that spontaneous acts do not. You come up against the Roman spear, and you react, outwardly and inwardly. Forced or not, helping others is central to being a good human, maybe our only true calling as we engage in our brief activity here on Earth. After all, wasn't that Jesus' main message? And it should be celebrated, even if in a goofy and obvious way. Like with pies. The neighborhood was part of the theme for the night, and one nearby business down on Dauphine Street was Hubig's Pies, an industrial bakery that had been operating fragrantly among the shotguns and Creole cottages of the neighborhood for almost 100 years, making fried, glazed, single-serve pies that you could grab from cardboard trays next to cash registers all over town. I loved the peach. Its famous mascot on the wrappers and on the sides of the white delivery vans was Simon the Pieman, aproned and corpulent, brandishing a big pie. I brought a bag full of Simon's pies to distribute in case anyone needed a snack during our night journey. On each pie wrapper, I'd written phrases in Sharpie that we utter throughout the day, without even thinking, all these small gestures of burden lifting. Do you need a hand with that? Here, let me help. I can get that for you. Do you need to talk? A few months after the Way of the Crisis, Hubig's bakery burned down to the ground. Tired grave shift employee, unattended oil fire, causing an early morning citywide rush on Hubig's pies as the news spread. The loss hurt, but we're used to it. New Orleans has such a penchant for losing its best. But the fire was months away. We were still at the playground after Sarah's moving piece about mothers and meaning, eating pies, surrounded by the chalky questions we'd all written.
Now that's commitment. I love that you thought of Simon. Of course, I love that. And then you all, after the Stations of the Crisis, repaired to your home for The Last Supper.
Right, The Last Supper. I mean, right. It's just such a light joke.
I know. But such a New Orleans joke at the same time, you know? Oh, man.
Because we know there is no Last Supper.
Of course.
Really. Yeah. But
so when did you know this experience would turn into a book?
I think I knew after the first meeting that I wanted to write about it. As I already said, my father had passed away. I was already grieving and thinking about these big issues. the readings were resonating so deeply and resonating with other parts of my life and other readings in my life. And things just started bouncing off of each other in such a compelling way. I knew that I had to start writing it down. And I kind of held off for a little bit because I wanted to see where things went. I didn't want my desire to write about it to skew the experience of living it. I kind of wanted people to choose things. I wanted the experience to unfold naturally and not have my desire to write about it interfere with how things were unfolding and how things would play out. But I think about halfway through, about 6 months through, I started writing about it in earnest. And also because it was just such a precious, precious thing to me to have these meetings where I felt I was in such a safe place to talk about all of these things with other people. And it's not like group therapy or anything. And it's funny when people refer to it as being a spiritual thing. When I was reading it, it seemed way more like this intellectual exercise. And only did I really start writing it, did it start to feel more like emotional or spiritually edifying. Just having the space to write about it and to just and work through things that were maybe not left unsaid during the meetings, but like when the meeting's over, it's not as though I stopped thinking about that topic. I would wake up the next morning, throughout the week, I would be thinking about these things, driving around, you know, taking my kids to school, running errands, working. Those things would resonate throughout my day, and I would keep thinking about them and keep thinking about them and what other people had said. So writing it all down helped me kind of capture the experience and make sense of it for myself, because my brain can be kind of messy and undisciplined. And so putting it down on the paper helped me kind of sort things out as well.
All brains are messy. You know? But also writing about it, you put it in the context of your larger life. And so, of course, so much of that is spiritual, given that you're dealing with loss, dealing with change. Mm-hmm. Living in New Orleans at a time of such searching for everyone who lived here. So does the group continue?
Yes, absolutely. So it's been about 5 years now. And we still do Stations of the Crisis, although sometimes we alternate it with just a Last Supper and no stations. We used to be much better about meeting like clockwork, like last Thursday of the month. But over the years, you know, some people move away, new people join the group, and we still meet. We're not quite as like disciplined in terms of meeting every single month, but we keep going.
So talk about the title, The Futilitarians. People are so engaged by that word. You know, you can start your own church now if you really need to.
The Church of the Futilitarians.
Right.
Interestingly, it came up when we first started talking about this, and I know specifically who I think said it, but no one actually claims having said it. But I know it happened because my sister, Susan, takes amazing notes during the meeting. And I remember who brought up the Futilitarians, but nobody is taking credit for it. And we were just jokingly trying to come up with what to call this group. But I think it was in reaction to the first reading we had done was Ecclesiastes from the Old Testament. And there's a refrain, all is vanity, all is vanity, all is vanity, that kind of punctuates that whole thing. And so basically we started joking about, you know, the void and, you know, beyond our sensory perception. And we were just, that just became like this, a joke of the evening, this all is vanity. And so the Futilitarians was something that was thrown out there. And for me, when people ask sort of like what it means, I mean, it's obviously it's kind of a jokey name, but it also talks about sort of the usefulness of acknowledging the central absurdity of our lives, which is we are born into this world with the knowledge of our own deaths, and we have to keep going anyway. Like we have to just keep plugging away and keep trying to figure out like why we do these things. And so it might seem like a futile task, but it's extremely useful in terms of finding a way forward to live your life in a productive and meaningful way.
And we're always beginning again.
Yes.
Always.
Yep, always.
So I wonder, in the sense of always beginning again, if you would read your passage about the metaphysical hangover.
Ah, the metaphysical hangover.
Which
yes.
is such a New Orleans thing to have.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's lots of different hangovers. And of course, the civic hangover is one that we talk about, too, in terms of New Orleans. I've always appreciated the morning of the day after a bad hangover. Waking up full of gratitude for yet another second chance, remembering what feeling good is like. So much possibility and productivity lie before you, before the day locks in, starts its inexorable work towards sundown, when you could kind of use a drink. Luckily, for most of us, the hangover is just part of the cycle of good times, the hard fall, regeneration. For others, the fall is continuous and recovery is out of reach. When they finally succumb, their metaphysical hangovers are inherited by those around them. We survivors then struggle through it with all of our excellent intentions, negotiating the ebb and flow, the endless searches for something to get us through to that new morning. The ECRG had reinforced that while searching, we should remind ourselves of the gifts of the hangover, the renewed sensitivity to the suffering of others and the tender generosity toward our own suffering, the extra necessity for kindness and patience. We hope, we know, that there's health and good feeling on the other side. We just have to get through this bad stretch, either alone or with all the others out there willing to share their remedies.
I love that. That is really beautiful, I think.
Thank you.
Well, so much of this book, you know, speaks to me particularly of what books can do, of what talking about books can mean to people. So I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about that consolation or inspiration or whatever you found from this year of reading so intentionally. Mm-hmm. I mean, when I think of this book, you know, I think of that wonderful essay you wrote for the Oxford American, Bell Chase, The Beautiful Hunt. And I think of Walker Percy's search. And in some ways, this was a search through books for you, mm-hmm. for all of you.
It was. And I think, I mean, first of all, I've got a very different relationship with literature because I teach writing.
Right.
And so that's kind of what I do every day is I talk and I discuss with my students at NOCA sort of what good writing is, the importance of writing, why we write. We look at the best examples of literature that we can find. And so for me, that's reinforced like on a professional level every single day. I think that these readings in particular and what they continue to do, no matter what the reading is kind of give me an opportunity, a space to confront certain things in my life or in life in general that you're maybe like kind of too busy to deal with on a regular basis. And I think the difference with a group is that you're sort of accountable to everyone else in the group as well. And you know that they're home, their couches and beds or whatever, and they're reading these things at the same time. And you know you can look forward to everybody getting together and opening up that bottle of wine and everyone kind of like engaging with it with their best selves in a way. And so in anticipation of that, like reading something for the ECRG is a different experience than reading something for my class or reading something just because I want to for pleasure or something. I know that this is it's sort of like for almost like for a higher kind of sacred thing. I'm also always in anticipation of not only what I'm going to learn from the text, but what other people are going to say, how other people are going to change my mind about things or make me think about things in a different way or disagree with what I have to say or say things in a much smarter way than I could ever articulate. And so, like, I've got a sense of gratitude not only for the readings, but for what the other people bring to the group as well.
Yeah, no, it's so interesting to live a life as a professional reader in a way mm-hmm. and then have something like this reconnect you to what it is that it's very best and most meaningful, I think.
Yeah.
This was a good year. It was a rich, full year. That's
it was very rich. It was very full. Yes, indeed.
Well, good for the reader, too. We've been talking with Anne Gislason about her new memoir, The Futilitarians, Our Year of Thinking, Drinking, Grieving, and Reading. You can meet her Thursday, August 24th at 7 at the Saturn Bar, 3067 St. Claude Avenue. Anne, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Susan. It's been a pleasure.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Mystery novelist Leah Penn, author of Pure Death and Pure Justice, Colleen Mooney, author of Rescued by a Kiss, Dead and Breakfast, and Drive Through Murder, and Nancy Bourgeois, author of Murder Behind the Mask, discuss and sign their books Tuesday, August 22nd at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. If you love to read the New Yorker magazine, consider joining the New Yorker Reading Group. It meets every Tuesday from 1 to 2:30 at the Rosa Keller branch of the New Orleans Public Library. One Book, One New Orleans kicks off its fall season of events Thursday, August 24th from 6 to 8 at Pelican Bay Restaurant, 1701 Elysian Fields. What a great time to start reading Clint Smith's wonderful poetry selection, Counting Descent. This event is free and family friendly. Today's guest, Anne Gislason, signs The Futilitarians, Our Year of Thinking, Drinking, Grieving, and Reading, Thursday, August 24th at 7 at the Saturn Bar. Erica Spindler signs The Other Girls, Saturday, August 26th at 1 at Barnes & Noble Mandeville, and again Sunday, August 27th at 2 at Barnes & Noble Metairie. Margaret Wilkerson Sexton signs A Kind of Freedom, Saturday, August 26th at 6 at Octavia Books. Bryce Ainsworth signs his debut novel, A Minor Fall, Sunday, August 27th at 2 at Garden District Bookshop. The North Shore's Big Fat Book Club is taking on Emma by Jane Austen this fall, starting Monday, September 11th through Monday, October 2nd, meeting from 3:30 to 5 at the home of Susan Blaylock. She facilitates the group in Abita Springs. There is a fee, and for more information, email Abita Blaylock, that's B-L-A-L-O-C-K, at gmail.com. When the Southern Independent Booksellers Association meets here September 12th through 15th, one of the highlights is Read NOLA, which takes place Sunday, September 17th from noon to 6 at the Sheraton, New Orleans. It features authors Christine Baker Klein and Jocelyn Jackson in conversation, along with 17 other authors. Tickets are available at SIBA, S-I-B-A, web, dot, site, S-I-T-E, dash, Y-M, dot, com. The Fall 2017 New Orleans Writers Workshop semester begins September 18th. The New Orleans Writers Workshop, a community writing program taught by trained published authors, is offering courses of varied lengths, 9-week, 4-week, 2-day, and 1-day, at locations around the city, including NOCA, Antenna, the Ogden Museum of Southern Art, the New Orleans Museum of Art, and the Rosa Keller Library. All skill levels are welcome. Visit NewOrleansWriters.com to register. We have a lot to celebrate on The Reading Life. First off, a big congratulations to two award winners. Tulane University's Bernice McFadden's The Book of Harlan won the American Book Award for Fiction. This is the second award for that book, which also won an NAACP Image Award. Michael Tisserand's Crazy, George Harriman, A Life in Black and White, received the 2017 Eisner Book Award for the Best Comics-Related Book. And also a big congratulations to our new State Poet Laureate, Jack Bedell of Southeastern Louisiana University. His most recent books are Call and Response, Come Rain, Come Shine, and French Connections, a gathering of Franco-American poets. And this week marks a sad event with the closing of Maple Street Bookshop, an uptown fixture on the local literary scene for 53 years. This bookstore is known for its colorful history from Mary Faust and Rhoda Norman, then Mary's daughter Rhoda, and then Donna Allen, and now Gladden Scott. Maple Street was all over town for a while, and bookstore veterans Britton Trice and the late Mark Zumpy are Maple Street alums as well. It's a store that's famous for its association with Walker Percy and Thelma Toole, and it's been immortalized in Ellen Gilchrist fiction. Everyone knows their motto emblazoned on t-shirts and book bags, Fight the Stupids. Well done, Maple Street and Gladden Scott and Cindy Dyke and everyone who is part of this great bookstore. Well done indeed. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press, and the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org. Thanks for listening and keep reading.